This is...
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Politics.
Politics. So here's a little insight on our insider, our minister of interpretation. Butsang, welcome, brother man.
Thank you, and thanks for the introduction. A celebrity, I wish one day I reached that status. You know, I always watch your show with all these celebrities, yes, and sir. I'm like, wow, people have interesting lives.
Raised on the West Rand of Johannesburg.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, take us back to what is now Mogale City.
Well, I was actually born in Mogale City.
Yes.
To be exact, the hospital that used to be called Paradekral Hospital, It is now called Dr. Yusuf Dadu Hospital,
yes.
Which is in Mogale City, the former Krugersdorp. While my parents actually, I'm coming from Randfontein, you know, in Mohlakeng, Dusty sure. Street. The reason I was born there actually, in a white people hospital with privileges, is because of my grandmother, who was what they used to call kitchen mate or helper, worked on a family that had arranged that my mother, who was 19 years old, to give birth at a hospital with, sure. with you know, better facilities. But I grew up in Randfontein.
Sure.
I always tell people Kasia Motlake has produced the superstars of South Africa, the sure. Asin Twillings, the Benson Clodies, the Terra Matebulas, Boban Piri, and Botsa Mwila at the end. Mwila. I
yes,
always
sir.
Say that.
Who is Pule? Tell us about Pule.
Pule is my brother. Yeah. My cousin, we grew up in one house actually, because my parents, I think they only had our own home
sure.
around 1976, if I'm not mistaken. And I grew up with Pule Mwilwa in one house, Mwana Ramukul, the brother to my father. So Pule is basically my elder brother.
So Pule, when you are four in 1976, starts grade one.
Yes, because he's 2 years older than me.
Yes.
Yes.
But where now, because also Khalo Papa insists, I also want to go to school.
Well, I Fresh, I vividly recall my first day at school in 1976 during grade one. But basically what happened, and the storyline is, I cried so much that Pude was leaving me home to go to start school. And I forced to go to school, and you know the story I'm getting is that my dad, my mom said to my dad, do something about it, and my dad said, give me that child, I'll show you what I'll do with this, I'll stop him from crying, and that's how I started school. But the storyline is, when my dad took me to school, he called the principal on the side and the teacher and said, look, he's four, I know he doesn't qualify, but just make life a living hell for him today at school, that he must cry, you know, to come back home. That never happened. The rebel in me started at that time.
In fact, I'm told that despite the fact that you are not officially a student, you were top of the class that year.
I still have my substandard A. That's what they call grade one.
Yes, yes, yes.
My mom kept all our school reports. I still have my substandard A.
Yes.
Grade one report. I came out number one, H4. I was number one of the class, unregistered. So they were literally stuck with me now. Now I'm the best performer in class.
Yes.
I'm unregistered. And the school principal at that time, and my school teacher, you know, may her soul rest in peace, Masimenu, said, I'm not losing this child. That's how my, academic or school year started.
When did your conscientization happen in terms of what's happening in this unjust society that you're growing up in?
Look,
do you remember the point?
I think it happened after my dad had a house, and it was in the late 70s, probably age 8, 9, and 10. And the reason is there was too much movement at home. We grew up in a 3-room house, not 3-bedroom, kitchen, living room, and the parents' bedroom. But there was too many movement in the house. So then I thought it was church people, because my dad was an elder of the church. But then I realized, no, these are not people I see in church. It was other people. And only to find out that my father was an activist in a civic movement. And so the people who were frequenting home, especially in the late 70s, were political activists. And now, living in a 3-room house, and we are sitting in the kitchen, and they're in the living room, or they're sitting in the kitchen, we're in the living room, My ear was not glued. I don't even think we had TV at that time.
Yeah, you listened to Bound to Radio.
I was listening. They would switch off the radio in order for them to talk.
Sure.
And I hear things that, you know, they probably thought he's too young to can understand this. That's when I actually my eyes got open regarding politics and things like that. And I started paying attention. And I discovered that actually my dad is a civil, you know, society leader. He's a Pan-Africanist. Then I started asking him questions later in life. I can tell you that by age 12, I was actually, I remember, you see, at home being the royal families, that when you reach age 12, which is age of puberty, you are given rules and regulations.
Sure.
You know, in the rural areas, you'll be taken to the mountain to be groomed to become a boy.
Yes.
And one of the things that my parents instilled on me was my gift at age 12 was 2 Parker pens, a pen and a pencil.
Mm.
And I still have the note today that my dad wrote to me to say, my son, these things are not pens. These are weapons of war.
Yes.
Use them wise. I had those pens for over 20 years.
Oh,
it
wow.
was a Parker set, very expensive Parker set. And I still have the letter. So for me, he was preparing me. And then I started writing. You know, at age 12, I had a gift set of 2 Parker pens.
Yeah.
I started writing.
Do you remember what you were writing at the time?
Mostly it was cool things. Mostly, I like poetry when I grew up. I will write a lot of poems. And it was not in politics.
Yeah.
I actually started writing politics around age 14, 15.
You know,
Fresh, at age 16, and I Googled, it is still there, my first newspaper article, I was under a code name, Mwafrika Poto.
Oh, wow.
And sometimes I will use what I used in politics, Obrimo Sekle. So Mwafrika Poto, Botsa Mwilwa, Obrimo Sekle is the same person.
Oh, wow.
My first article, I was 16 years of old.
So this would have been 1988, 89.
It was, exactly.
Yes.
It was in the Sowetan. It was actually immediately after the formation of PASO, the Pan-Africanist Student Organization, in 1988. I wrote my first article to the Sowetan at that time, but under a code name.
Yeah.
And in that instance, we you know, I was exposed to writing. So writing has been in me.
It's been your thing.
Has been my thing, and it was into the Sowetan.
But also in high school, you're a bit of a rebel.
And I'm
told you missed a year of school because you're a rebel.
Well, actually, I didn't really miss a year at school. You know, it was those years, the year we spoke about it in one of our past shows.
Yes.
I did not write my standard 9 exams that particular year because I left the country. I was an activist.
Yes.
It actually started first in 1985. It was called the International Youth Year.
Yes.
Where, you know, students, we revolted all over. We became the 76 youth of the 80s. And the high school I was attending, to AB Pukumbe Senior Secondary, it was a very notorious school with rebellions and all that. And I was one of the youngest. So it started there, the grooming, the activism. But when I was already doing standard 9, which is grade 1, grade 11 today, just before exams, around which normally they would start in November, around, it was one year after you know, we moved to a new building, a new school, and around, I think, August, July, we started, you know, celebrating the 1 year existence of the Pan-Africanist Student Organization. So instead of going to an annual congress of the student organization, I end up in a military camp.
Briefly as possible, take us through your days in exile. As a child, I mean, you're a child, you're getting military training, you're outside the country.
Literally, I don't like the word exile because I didn't skip the country as others. We left briefly. We and I've said to people before, we end up in the Transkei Defense Force military camps under, you know, Major General Bantu Lomisa that time. And he facilitated us leaving the country. Some went to MK camps, some to Azanla camps in Botswana, and some of us, we end up in Zimbabwe and Tanzania in the Apla military camp. So it was what they used to call a bridging course on using arms and ammunition.
Sure.
So it didn't like you go for military training for 6 months or what. It lasted a couple of number of weeks, and then we had to come into the country unarmed. The arms would find us in the country, or we'll find them in the country. So it was a short course in using arms, and it was basically an AK-47, a Scorpion machine gun, which was notorious with APLA, and a hand grenade and a pistol. So basically it was that, then we'll come back into the country.
At that stage, were you willing to put your life on the line for the country?
The fact that I had run away from home, abandoned family, abandoned school, and end up in a military camp, it's a clear sign that I was prepared to put my life on line.
Did you ever have to use your training?
Several times. It happened several times. Yeah. Actually, you know, 2 weeks ago, I drove a friend to Naledi. And then I discovered that the road that passes Hani Baragwanath Hospital is closed, it's under construction.
Yeah.
So we had to take some roads and pass Moletsane and Tadi. And I passed a place where I once had a military operation. There used to be a 52 battalion.
So what year was this?
Now 1991.
Okay, so you're
18, 19, 20. I was 17.
You're 17?
Yes.
Okay.
I was 17.
So that would probably be about 89, 90.
Then. 89, 90, yeah. Actually, it was in the year of the Great Storm, 1990.
Sure. You know.
So there was a military barrack in Tladi. And it was the 52 Battalion South African Defence Force Military Barrack. And one of the operations I was involved with, you see, I thought APLA forces were mad, and I still think we were crazy, because it was not planting bombs.
Sure.
The three of us, we walked armed into that military by we attacked soldiers. That's one of the operations I was involved with. But I was the youngest of the other guys were 2 years older than me.
Yeah.
So all I needed to do was to carry a sidearm. A sidearm is what you call a pistol.
Yes.
And them with machine guns. Scorpion is a very small submachine gun, you know, right? They walked in there. So I had to throw a grenade and wait at the gate to cover them when they come out running after executing the mission. Jump into the car, none of us was caught. Disappeared into the dark side of Soweto.
So you're driving to these barracks?
Yeah, I'm a passenger. We are four. There's a driver and three operatives.
You guys are driving to these barracks. You're still a child.
Well,
you're a child. You're a child. And you guys are driving there. What's going through your head at that stage?
That I may come out not alive. That I may be killed. That we may find the soldiers ready at the gate.
Yes.
We won't even enter. And so the two other operatives, the strategy was very clear. The two other, you go in there, you're not suspected. You are tiny, you are little, you are boots, and you're not. You throw in a grenade to the four soldiers at the gate. As they go mad, the other guys walk in, start shooting randomly, come out running. The driver is sitting in the car. The driver is not a guerrilla. He's not from exile. He's not trained. He is a getaway vehicle. Drive it somewhere, abandon everything except weapons. Abandon everything. I didn't have to use the side pistol because they caught the soldiers off guard, and when they came out running, they were not under
you didn't need to cover them.
I didn't need to cover them.
Yeah.
We drove in, dropped the car. I didn't know Soweto that time, but I know I was in the middle of Soweto. We had other people who took us, drove us to other places. And you know, that was the most dangerous operation I've ever been in.
But I'm told one of the things about it was APLA, right?
Yes.
Is the fact that often a lot of your operations succeeded because the cells were always small.
The numbers.
It was always me and someone else.
Yeah.
So there's less of a chance that there'll be a snitch. How true is that?
That is very true.
Yeah.
Whoever informed you that. How APLA was formed, we were influenced by the Hamas and the Palestinian and the you know, rebel military movement in Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
In that. So the idea was, the smaller you are in a cell, the lesser the numbers you are, the lesser the risk of being caught.
Yes.
We were never more than three. We were never 5 or 10 people in one operation. There may be other people involved sitting somewhere, but those who are carrying the operation had to be three people. And these three people will go and carry out an operation, and you split. But you know, the former PAC chairperson and who was the commander in chief of APLA, Johnson Mlambo, we used to call him Chairman River. He used to say something, I'm sending you, the three of you, out. I'm sending you out. You come back, the three of you. Even if one is a corpse, you do not leave a trace behind. If you are in
including a body. Yeah.
If you are in a situation whereby you cannot carry the body, it's fine. But should you carry the body, you know, you must cover your tracks. Just take the body with And I know one set operation I was involved in, we had to leave the body. You know, one of the guys, we had an operation in Pretoria East. And we had to leave the guy in the car.
So what was that operation in Pretoria East?
Fundraising. It was another operation. And we were going to, for fundraising. You call it armed robbery today. The liberation movement needed money and all those things. And as we approach that area, and I heard somebody talking about it who was a cop at that time, and I'm like, oh gosh, now in recent years.
Yes.
And as we were driving there, I think the police got a tip.
Yes.
Again, we are four. I'm at the back seat with this guy. There's a driver and another guy in front. And we're driving a Toyota Cressida. And the guy who was driving said, look, I can leave them. They're in a buggy. But the guy I'm sitting with at the back is insisting that we've got an operation. We need money. We won't have anywhere to move. Chief, I'm telling you, this guy opened the door of the car because they started the sirens and to stop us. He opened the door of the car. Now, four black men in a Cressida. Cressida is an expensive vehicle at that time. He opened, as the car is moving, the place is called, the street these days is called, I think, January Masilele or something like that. He opened the door of the car as it's driving. He, you know, laid down and took out his arm and started shooting at the cops as we are driving. We couldn't shoot back. We are scared and they started shooting back at us. Drove the car into, you know, Pretoria East suburbs and all that. Abandoned the car with everything. And sadly, you know, Bongani was killed. And that was the closest to death I've ever been. But I don't like to remember those days. You know, sometimes when you think of people laid their lives for this country and we look at what is happening today, it's a sad state of affairs.
Sure. Let's fast forward to 1990, February. You are 18 years old. Madiba is coming out of prison.
Well,
do you remember where you were, what was going through your head at the time?
I remember vividly. I remember the February, 11th of February, 1990. And I remember seeing UDF leaders that I knew in their community marching and toying and celebrating. But I'm a Pan-Africanist, so it meant nothing to me. And Mandela came out and people are... And we were conflicted. We were caught up in a situation. We had just... you know, being trained and being told Sabelo Palmer, the APLA commander at that time, is launching Operation Great Storm. So, which meant we must intensify the armed struggle towards the white settler regime. That's where we were. And now suddenly there is this Madiba coming out of prison and MK is laying down its arms and we're being dragged into that whole place. So I was very unhappy. But I was living in the clandestine. I was reserved, quiet, because I did not know that people should know that I am politically active.
Yes.
I remember sitting in my yard, watering the garden, seeing people excited about it. So I was dealing with a situation here to say, I know there's arms somewhere. I'm supposed to be using them and fighting and going to school because I was a student at the time. I think in 1990, I was doing my first year at tertiary. And I had to be seen as this young, dull, boring boy who's a nerd, who likes books. So it didn't mean that much to me. And
did you ever feel like you are Superman? That during the day you're wearing your spectacles, you're studying, but at night you're like Superman with a...
not really Superman, but there was a saying in the country that was going to say, Paso by day, which is student, and Apla by night.
Oh, yes.
Understand? There was that slogan, the Paso by day, Apla by night. The PAC insisted on us going to school a lot. And we thought they wanted us to get educated. But I can tell you, it was also a strategy to say, never be seen as an idling young black man. That's a strategy, it was a military strategy to say, go to school, be boring, have homeworks and your assignment. Time for operations, you are somebody else.
So you were doing first year at the time, like you said.
Yes.
So what did you graduate as?
I graduated, and I always tell people, that's my most important qualification. I'm a public administrator. I was studying public administration. And that's what led me to government. That was not my plan. My plan was to go study and be a lawyer. I was accepted at the University of Fort Hare. I wanted to be a lawyer. My parents did not have money to take me to Fort Hare. So I had to study with the now University of South Africa and a correspondence. It was cheaper, affordable. So I ended up studying public administration. Now, when I was doing my third year, and this is very important for my life, you know, the country was already in the Condesa negotiation process. I was one of the rebels within the PAC who was against the Condesa negotiations. I vividly recall, actually, the advocate then, Dikgang Moseneke, the chief, the former deputy chief justice, was the deputy president of the PAC. And the people like the late Khoisan X, Benny Alexander, they tried to calm us down to say, your commanders sitting in Dar es Salaam and Harare are saying you must listen to us in the country, and you are going to listen to us. So we were rebelling against that process. We wanted to only hear Johnson Mlambo, the river, or Sabelo Obama telling us, put these things down, okay? Sure. During that whole process, the most radical PAC leaders get killed. Jafta Kalabi Masemola, the longest serving political prisoner this country has ever had in Robben Island, get killed in a freak car accident. Sabelo Obama, the commander-in-chief of APLA forces, get killed in a car accident between Tanzania and Harare. You understand? So so now our things are getting worse and we are getting more angry. But then during that time, the PAC entered the negotiations. So we were calmed down. You know, Advocate Dikgang Moseneke or Chief Justice Dikgang Moseneke was in the forefront and said, guys, wait a little bit. We are putting the arms struggle aside. Let us get into these negotiations. And then I decided, okay, the struggle has been abandoned. Let me also start looking for a job. The then Department of Foreign Affairs, under Pek Velum Buota, Pek Buota, advertises in the city press a post to join Foreign Affairs. And I look at it, and they wanted people with public administration and communication science. Exactly what I was studying, but I'm doing the last year. And then I took that, and I showed it, guess to who? To Kata Seleka, the former PAC Deputy Secretary General. And he said to me, Mfanagit, put this through. Put your application through. And that's what I did. And that's how I end up in Foreign Affairs. But guess what? They pressed buttons. The PAC deployed me into the racist apartheid government as a spy. Now, how old I am? I'm 20.
Wow.
At the age of 20, 1st of March 1993, so I served the apartheid government. 1st of March 1993, I joined the then Department of Foreign Affairs and Information. Guess as what? Reprographic service officer. My duty was to make photocopies.
Oh, wow.
Strategic position.
Yeah.
So every document classified, I had a security clearance, classified. I would operate a machine that was making trips of ministers and meetings where and what. That's what the PAC wanted. They wanted to know which minister is traveling where, what time and all that. And imagine, I end up in that job.
How in danger were you in that job?
I was not. Look, the people thought that the apartheid government was the best. Remember, there's not a military operation now. And nobody knew that I come from APLA, you know, camps. And there's no guns, there's nothing. I'm just a young boy who's studying public administration.
Embedded, making photocopies.
Making photocopies, boring and sitting there in the corner. And I don't talk. Yeah. I don't tell anybody anything about that. I'm quiet. I'm looking like a photocopy machine operator. Completed my final year. And this became that. Yeah, the rest is in my biography. And if people want to read what happened after, you know, I've captured it in the book. That's why at a young age I wrote a biography.
Tell us about your biography. What is it called?
Well, Life with a Question Mark, Life with a Rebel. I must say, why Life with a Question Mark? You know, it's a very interesting story quickly. When I became a diplomat, my first assignment was to Germany. I was the vice consul of South Africa to Germany. And at age 24.
What year is this?
Age 24. This was 1996.
Yes.
So 1995, we're in a democratic South Africa. Nelson Mandela is the president. I go for diplomatic training.
But how at odds are you with what you need to do versus what you felt about the negotiated settlement?
I still say I surprised myself how I managed to switch from being a Pan-Africanist who is serving the government of the day, the government of Nelson Mandela and the ANC. So I actually could draw a line between being an activist or a guerrilla and an employee of the government of the day. That's why, you know, to this modern day age, I always tell people, I'm a public administrator.
Yes.
I was sitting in a government office to do government work. And guess what? I'm surrounded by former apartheid employees,
yes,
Afrikaners, and guess my black brothers who are from the ANC. Everybody around me was from the ANC.
Sure.
In the Department of Foreign Affairs and Information, we were at that time in the early 90s in administration, less than 10 black people. I was the only one who came from the PAC.
Sure.
At that time. But I managed to contain myself and to work, because for me it was about the country. It was not about which political party do you come from. It was about the country, and I managed to, you know, swim over that and focus on doing the job and the assignments that were given. And the reward became what? The state entrusted me with a diplomatic training to do what? Not politics.
Yes.
To become a head of administration and finance and consular services. Now, those are the most important, you know, elements. Now, you trust somebody who doesn't come from the ANC with money?
Yes.
In dollars and German marks, with consular services, you know, registering human life. And at age 24, you become a vice consul.
Did that feel almost like an olive branch, given how a lot of Pan-Africanists were not happy with everything that happened between 1990 and 94?
Yes.
Where a lot of Pan-Africanists felt like, why are we being treated like we're never part of the fight for independence,
for liberation? I can tell you that was part of it.
Let me finish the question. And did you at any stage feel like maybe you are selling out now?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think, I've never felt like I'm selling out, because first of all, remember I had said earlier on, the PAC, the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, they knew where I was and what I was doing.
Sure.
And there were a number, remember the PAC had now joined the negotiation process. There were a number of Pan-Africanists who served in government in various roles.
Sure. Sure.
You understand? And so I didn't feel like it was a betrayal. But also, there was this thing of saying, let us watch Mavarara.
Sure.
You know, Mavarara meaning the Chatterists.
Yes.
Remember, we are the Zimzims, they are the Chatterists. Let us be there, be inside, influence the info, the situation, and watch that they are doing what the liberation movement was intended to do. So the PAC didn't become hostile to the ANC. That's why most, and most of PAC members who went into government, I don't even know one person from PAC who went into who failed. Most excelled in what they were doing. You know, for us, it was saving the government of the day.
So you go to Germany,
yeah.
You are 24.
No, I was 24, yes.
Yeah, 24.
Got married, had a child, moved to Germany.
So everything is happening like this.
You know, Fresh.
Talk to us about the pressure and keeping up with that pressure.
Yeah, I sometimes sit down and I've read my biography 6 times.
Yes.
And every time I read it, I find something very amusing about myself.
Sure.
That at age 21, where every parent throws in a 21st birthday party.
Yeah.
For their kids, I was already earning a salary.
Sure.
I started working at age 20. I threw in my own 21st birthday celebration. That's one.
Sure.
I'm still having arms. I'm still having my scorpion and my firearms and all that. I then start having, you know, a formal relationship, meet a woman. Then I want a child. Then when I'm in the middle of that, I'm nominated to go for diplomatic training. I actually, on record, was the first black person in South Africa to be trained as head of corporate services abroad.
Oh, wow.
At 23, because
yeah.
I became a diplomat at 24.
Yeah.
So then I there was too much pressure. You understand? I left home. I was living in Atteridgeville.
Sure.
When I did my diplomatic training, I was staying in Soshanguve, actually. And then there's this woman next to me as well. Then suddenly there's a baby. Then suddenly I have to leave the country. And that caused a storm in my family.
Yeah.
Because I said to my family, I'm getting married. And everybody was like, are you mad?
Yeah.
How do you get married? And I'm 23.
Yeah.
We are getting married because we have a child. No. I'm getting married because I have a woman I love, and we have a child, and I'm going abroad. I'm not leaving my family behind.
Yes.
You know, that delayed my posting. I was supposed to have left the country in January 1996 to Frankfurt, Germany.
Sure.
Because of the infighting of me wanting to get married and all that, and the family saying that, I'm like, I'm not leaving my family. So I was even prepared to sacrifice my diplomatic career, this time not for liberation or for fighting, but for love. This thing called love.
In fact, we're going to hold it there.
Okay.
And we'll talk about the rest in part two of our Butsa Butsang interview.
No, we can do that.
When we do our part two, we'll talk about his setting up a mission in Rwanda. After the world ignored Rwanda and people were massacred in Rwanda, this was one of the first men that was sent to Rwanda to set up a diplomatic office there. We'll talk about your run-in with the office of President Mbeki.
Okay.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about marriage. We'll talk about divorce. We'll talk about how customary law let him down in his marriage, in his opinion. We'll talk about the paradox that he is. He's a Buddhist, but collects guns and swords and is a brown belt.
No. I'm actually a black belt.
Oh, so you made it to black?
Yeah, well, when I was in Germany, I got my first black belt. I've got my first then black belt in Shotokan.
Yo!
It's not only guns and knives.
Yes.
I execute kakatogiris as well.
All of that and Mawashi Geris and my Geris and every other Geri in part two of Butsa Butsang. Hopefully you enjoyed part one.
This is... What a week. What a week.
And that was our special segment with our special guest for the week, Butsang Muilwa. Don't forget the book is available, Life with a Question Mark, self-published. Find him on social media. And when we do part two, find out why this book cost him his job. Shout out to Amped Studios for hosting us, Africa Podcast Network. We are family. I've got all my brothers and sisters with me. Pezulu Works, love your cinematography. Our audio engineer, Otis The Flow Fraser. Creative director, Kuvesh Mohan. Show producer, Keletso Mudisa King. Email waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Have a great week in spite of yourselves.